The future of behavioral health is happening right now. There has been an old standing paradigm where we assess mental health not via objective measures, but based on subjective one-off surveys where we ask people, how do you feel? How did you sleep? How is your relationships? And while we may perceive that the relationships are one way, there is often objective measures that can show us something else. We may think that we're sleeping well when really we're not. We may think that we're eating well when really we're eating foods that our body is slightly allergic to. We need to find a way to use research, evidence, and modern technology to revolutionize the delivery of mental health care. Kasana Health was founded in 2019 in Eugene, Oregon, to make tools and findings developed by the University of Oregon Center for Digital Mental Health into products and services that aim to transform mental health care and research. The company is led by Dr. Nick Allen, a professor of clinical psychology with extensive research and clinical experience, as well as Will Short, an experienced software business leader and startup CEO. Kasana Health aims to give clients, practitioners, administrators, and researchers the digital tools that will define the future of mental health. These objective, passive, remote patient monitoring tools make ongoing assessment easy and accessible to researchers, behavioral health leaders, practitioners, health systems, and empower patients themselves to create transformative behavioral change that prevents mental health problems before they occur. This is the Lindsay Elmore Show. Welcome to the Lindsay Elmore Show, a podcast for people who deserve to be healthy, with honest, open, and enlightening conversations with doctors, thought leaders, creatives, and spiritual gurus. You'll walk away with simple and tangible tips and tricks that allow you to live your healthiest life so you can pursue your dreams, overcome obstacles, and leave your mark. Dr. Nick Allen co-founded Kasana Health in 2019 to translate the tools and technologies he developed as the director of the University of Oregon's Center for Digital Mental Health into products and services that will transform mental health care and research. Dr. Allen is a clinical psychologist and a social neuroscientist who investigates the interaction between biological, psychological, and environmental risk factors during adolescent development in order to more fully understand how to prevent mental health problems and encourage healthy development during this critical stage of life. His 30-plus years of experience in clinical psychology, social neuroscience, research, and education led him to develop two platforms available through Kasana Health. He is extraordinarily well-researched and published, and you can find all of his works on Google Scholar. Dr. Nick Allen, welcome to the Lindsay Elmore Show.
Thank you, Lindsay. It's great to be with you.
So I read in one of your articles that unprecedented global forces are shaping the health and well-being of the largest generation of 10 to 24-year-olds in human history. Population mobility, global communications, economic development, and the sustainability of ecosystems are setting the future course for this generation and, in turn, mankind. At the same time, we have new understandings of how adolescence is such a critical phase in life for achieving human potential. It's characterized by dynamic brain development, where the interaction of the social environment shapes the capabilities an individual takes forward into adult life. It's during adolescence that an individual acquires the physical, cognitive, emotional, social, and economic resources that are the foundation for later life health and well-being. These are the same resources that define trajectories into the next generation. From this life course, an intergenerational perspective, investments in adolescent health and well-being's benefit us today and for decades to come. The problem that you go through and talk about is how behavioral health has been flawed. We need to shift the way that we talk about behavioral health. And instead of going into these one-off kind of surveys, we need to look at really continuous objective data so that adolescents turn into very healthy adults. So talk to us about your outlook on behavioral health now and in the future.
Well, thanks for that introduction. It's always interesting to hear your writing read back to you.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's always interesting when you're a podcaster to hear your own voice on the radio, you know?
That's right. And so, thankfully I do still agree with what I said. So that's good. It's always a good point for some consistency there. But I think that, you know, that quote you took from, if I recognize it correctly, is from a paper that we did in Nature a few years ago. A review that really tried to set the stage for the importance of behavioral health, not only obviously across the whole lifespan, but particularly during adolescence. Adolescence is a period of life where people are learning, these fundamental skills, social, emotional, and self-regulatory skills that really form the foundation for your adult health and well-being. And so that's why we see it as such an important phase of life for investment, for healthcare, and for support. So to get to the second part of your question, you know, and so the question is, how do we do that? How do we do that in a more effective way? And one of the things that I've been very interested in recently, perhaps over the last decade in particular, is the way in which we measure things in behavioral health really provides fundamental limitations to us moving forward. So let me give you an example. Predicting the weather is a really, really hard thing to do, but we've gotten pretty good at it. And the reason we've gotten pretty good at it is because we have a lot of data and we can develop models around, you know, what works and what doesn't work in prediction. We can start to understand the mechanisms of weather much more in a detailed way. And compare that to, what we do typically in behavioral healthcare is we rely almost exclusively on measuring things through questionnaires of one type or another. So in other words, we either get people to fill out a paper and pencil questionnaire or one that's on a tablet or on a phone, or we just talk to them and we say, how are you doing? Now, let me be very clear. I do not think that these are problematic in and of themselves. I think they provide really important data, but they only provide part of the picture. Whenever we have a situation where we collect objective data along with this self-report data, we always find out that the objective data tells us something important that the self-report data can't. So there's some examples there, like if we measure people's sleep objectively as opposed to how they think they're sleeping. Another example is you're working with people who have difficulties with substance abuse and you're asking them whether they're using substances versus using a objective measure like a urine screen or something like that. And so you always find that the objective data tells you something extra and something important that either the person cannot or will not, for whatever reason, tell you themselves. Mm-hmm. And so this is the shift that we think needs to happen in mental and behavioral healthcare, because for so long we have relied exclusively on these methods that are subjective, so it's the person's opinion. Secondly, that only provide a snapshot in time, so that they only tell you something about what you can see right now. And of course, many of the things that we want to understand in with respect to people's behavior and their experience are in fact dynamic. They change over time. And in fact, that pattern of change over time turns out to be a pretty important piece of data for understanding what's going on. For example, does your mood change with the seasons? Does it change throughout the day? Does it change in response to stress? These sorts of questions are actually very important, both for diagnostic purposes, but also for planning treatments and interventions. So we need a new approach which allows us to collect data continuously and collect data objectively. And that's the solution that we've been working on recently that involves this little piece of technology that almost everybody carries with them right throughout their life right now. That is their smartphone.
Yeah. So talk to us more about the meeting of technology and behavioral health. I mean, you mentioned sleep trackers and, you know, I've got my Oura Ring on that's telling me about my sleep quality, that's measuring my heart rate variability throughout the day. And, you know, sometimes it tells me data that I don't like. And sometimes it's interesting because I'll wake up and feel amazing. And the sleep tracker is like, no, no, you did not sleep well last night. You got like 12 minutes of deep sleep. Or on the contrary, it's so interesting. Sometimes I'll wake up kind of feeling like crap and it's given me a sleep score of like 95. So where does technology meet behavioral health?
Well, I think you've put your finger on a very important topic, which is that, and by the way, I have an Oura Ring too and an Apple Watch. And so I'm very quantified, you know, in that sense and really track those things myself. But here's one of the important things that we've learned is that not every behavior that you can track is relevant for the most relevant one for every person. So people vary. So for example, it might be that for you, your sleep variability is not that big a determinant of your daily well-being. It might be something different. It might be to do with nutrition or social connection or the way you're thinking that day, or it might be to do with your amount of exercise or something else. You know, so there's lots of different, how much time you've spent in nature. You know, there's a lot of different things that could be determining that. And that will differ between people. So as opposed to some of the sleep trackers and the activity trackers, and you know, there's lots of those out there. The approach that we take is to say, we need to understand for an individual person, what is the signal that's important to them that they should be thinking about or working on? And so what we do is we collect all those kinds of data with the data that we collect from the smartphone, but it's a wide range of data. It's not just sleep. We look at sleep, we look at physical activity, we look at mobility, so how you're getting around the world, whether you're leaving home, whether you know how many places you're visiting, what kinds of places you're visiting. We look at language, which tells us a lot about your mood and your cognition. We look at the patterns of social relationships that you that are expressed in your connectivity on the phone to other people. And all of those data are then correlated with exactly what you talked about, which is one day you're feeling crappy and another day you're feeling full of beans. And so and what we do is we discover at a personalized level what is the most important correlate for you of that experience of well-being versus less well-being. So if it is sleep, great. You've got something now, you've got an insight, and you know that you can work on this particular factor of your lifestyle with a pretty good chance that if you are able to change it in a positive way, it'll have a beneficial effect. But if it's not sleep, it might be something different. It might be, you know, like I say, it could be your pattern of social communication. Maybe you need to look at your thinking styles. Maybe you need to look at your physical activity. Maybe you need to look at your nutrition. You know, there's lots of different things you could look at. And so we developed this personalized approach that allows every person to understand what are the things that for them look like the best leverage points for changing their life in a positive way.
And, you know, changing life in a positive way is hard. It's very, very hard. And, you know, you founded a company and you're leveraging all of this data to gain these insights on behavioral health. How do you then take it a step further and actually convince someone to make a transformative change?
Yeah, that's so you've put your finger on that is a very profound question that many people in my field are wrestling with, you know, and so my background is that I'm a clinical psychologist and I've worked in healthcare and in research and academic contexts my whole life. And so as a clinical psychologist, I've spent my whole life trying to work out how to help people behave, you know, change their lives in a positive way. That's the fundamental question. And, you know, there's that, there's the classic jokes like how many psychologists does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is only one, but the light bulb has to want to change. Mm. So, you know, that's a sort of a silly joke that makes the point that, you know, we can't, this is not about behavioral control. This is not about telling people what they should or need to do. It's about providing people with the tools when they're ready to make that change. So the very first thing is the readiness is a really big factor. And so finding the time to when people are really ready to make that commitment to change is really important. But then once they've made that commitment, you need to provide them with the tools. And there are a number of really fundamental laws that we've learned about behavior change in scientific research and in clinical practice that we can apply to helping people to know how to do that effectively. And so that's the other part of the solutions that we're working on with our company, Kasana Health, is not only the measurement part, but then, as you say, once you've got that insight, then helping to scaffold people's attempts at change so that they are more effective and more likely to be successful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You have to meet people where they are, but you are absolutely right. You cannot convince anyone to change unless they're ready to do it. And that's something in my previous life when I was actively practicing pharmacy, and I taught so many smoking cessation classes, so many tobacco cessation classes. And I have people that come to me and like roll into my Instagram and on my Facebook, and they're like, I really want my husband to quit smoking. I really want my child, and I really want my child to quit vaping. And I was like, what does your husband or your child have to say about that? And it's like, they don't care. And I'm like, then you don't care, you know? And you know, I've been very affected by alcoholism in my life. And in Al-Anon, we learn not to do for other people what they can do for themselves. We have to let people do for themselves. So you have pioneered something called ecotherapy, and I have no idea even what this is. Talk to us about what is ecotherapy and how does it relate to behavioral health and transformative change?
So I do need to kind of, before anyone who knows my background and career starts laughing too much, I have not pioneered this approach. I do have an interest in it and have had an interest in it. But there are other people who are much more, you know, worthy of that title. Let's just say, but look, you know, what we know is that the environments that people spend their time in do have an influence on their mental health and well-being. And one of the variables that's really become quite clear in the scientific research is that being in natural environments for a certain period of the day is something that is supportive to your mental health. We know that both from correlational studies, so just sort of you know, looking at how much time people spend in nature versus human-made environments and how that correlates. But of course, the problem with a correlational study is that you could say, well, of course, the people who are likely to spend more time in nature are feeling happier because they might be happier people to start with or something like that. So the really important evidence comes from experimental studies where you actually get people and you randomize them into different conditions where they're either exposed more or less to natural environments versus human-made environments. And there's a number of really interesting studies of that type that also show, you know, some benefit for this kind of exposure. So I think it's an area where that we haven't used enough in behavioral and mental health care, helping people to understand that because of our evolved nature as humans, there is something about these natural environments that is very calming, that it includes, you know, that it induces a state of relaxation and reflection or you know, and so forth. And, you know, you think about where we want to spend our vacations and where we want to spend our weekends and other times when we are seeking recreation, you know, we seek out very often these natural environments, and they're very very supportive of that. So I think it's, you know, that's what ecotherapy is. It's really just finding ways to introduce this concept of seeking out and enjoying natural environments. And you know, you can do that either just passively, like going for a walk in the park, literally, you know, and finding nature in your local environment. But also it can be part of a more active process where people go away on a like a journey or a camping experience or something like that. And they you know, and that brings together a whole lot of elements of that we know are really good for people, you know. So, you know, for example, working with a group of people that you form a strong bond with, you know, is really good for your mental health. Being in nature is really good for your mental health. Being more active is good for your mental health. Facing challenges and overcoming them is really good for your mental health. And so, you know, you've got all this kind of all these elements that come together often in these kinds of outdoor or wilderness experiences that really are contain the elements that we already know are really promotive of people's mental health.
We've talked a lot on the show. We talked with Dr. Eric Zielinski about the ancient Japanese practice of forest bathing. And I think it's a little bit of a misnomer because it doesn't just have to be a forest. As you just mentioned, it can be at the beach. It can be at the park. You can get those mental health benefits from simply being out in nature. And then I interviewed Joyce, who founded a company called 99 Walks, and it was all about, she describes that there's multiple kinds of walks that we can take where sometimes you just want to zone out on a podcast or listen to your favorite music. She also talks about how you can take a problem on a walk and like allow that to work itself out. And she and I talked a lot on the show about how there are specific benefits when women get together and walk in groups together. And we even see it allowing us to be, we fall into the same pace with one another, right? And so it's, we reflect each other's energy when we walk outside in groups. Now, I'd love, because, you know, the problem of mental health illnesses in adolescence is exploding. And I have a feeling it's only going to get worse because the past 2 years have really robbed children and adolescents. I mean, it robbed very young children of that exposure to the diversity in the microbiome that they need, but it robbed adolescents and teenagers of those super formative experiences. Before we get to the rest of my interview, let's take a break for a word from our sponsors. Have you been feeling like your energy is not what it used to be, or that you just can't think as clearly as you once did, or maybe that stress is just always surrounding you and impacting your mood and your behavior? You may be struggling with your overall mental fitness. Mental fitness is not just about brain power. It's about how do we center our focus, gain more confidence, become more resilient towards stress, and improve our physical performance alongside our mental performance. Inside of Amare's Mental Fitness Pack, you'll find 3 products specifically designed to help improve brain performance, increase energy and endurance, while simultaneously calming the body and brain, helping to lower stress so that you can think more clearly and have a healthy, positive mood. Inside of the Mental Fitness Pack, there are 3 products. There is Energy Plus, which delivers rapid improvements in both brain and physical performance. There is the Mood Plus, which I can personally attest helped me to have fewer feelings of anxiousness and reduced my restlessness and overall stress levels in just one dose. Then there's the Sleep Plus, which is going to help you to fall asleep faster and stay asleep longer. Believe it or not, mental fitness can also lead to pain. So there is a fourth product in here called Relief Plus that has been scientifically shown to help improve sports recovery and joint health while providing fast-acting and long-lasting relief from occasional aches and pains, which can help you to sleep better, overall enhancing your mental fitness. Get shopping now at lindseyelmore.com/amare. When you shop my link, you will save $10. And when you subscribe and save, you will get an additional 10% off. When you get started with the Mental Fitness Pack, you will be on your way to have improved brain performance and a calmer body and brain. Shop now at lindseyelmore.com/amare to save $10. And now, let's get back to the show. What is your current outlook on the youth mental health crisis that we have on our hands right now?
Yeah, well, I agree with you. There is really some compelling evidence that rates of these problems are rising in young people specifically over the last few decades. And I should say specific, and even more specifically in young women. So there is, you know, we do know that these things are increasing. It's not happening in other age groups to the same extent. And of course, there's lots of speculation about what the cause of this might be. You know, people, obviously the pandemic, as you rightly say, is in the lockdown provisions of that have resulted in a disruption to one of the core developmental tasks of adolescence, which is social relationships and learning within social relationships about feelings and relationships and emotions and all these sorts of things. And of course, you know, young people have been online through this period, and that has allowed them to maintain some of their social connections in a way that they couldn't have 30 years ago, for example. And so I guess that's the sense in which, you know, digital technology is something to be glad for at a time like this, because otherwise they would have been extremely isolated. But on the other hand, you know, there are aspects of using digital technology that people are very concerned about. Part of this is, so we've just talked about nature and activity, and, you know, there is a concern that as if young people become less active because of their use of technology, that might be a difficulty. Another area is sleep disruption. So youth can often have poor sleep, and there's a particular pattern of sleep that we see in adolescence, you know, where they actually biologically, their circadian clock moves so that they'd rather go to sleep later at night and wake up later in the morning. But of course, with school, they have to get up at a rigid time. And then one of the things that's often keeping them up later at night is use of digital technology, being online in one way or another, especially with social media networks. And so we've got this capacity for it to disrupt people's sleep, which we know is a very strong correlate of people's mental health. And then, of course, you know, you get this thing that happens where on the weekends the kids do sleep in a lot to catch up on their sleep, and that moves their circadian rhythm further forward. And then when it comes to Monday, they've got to shift it back. And so it's almost like they've got a dose of jet lag every week, you know, which really does impede their capacity to benefit from school and to, you know, manage their, you know, all the things that they're dealing with, you know, their emotions and their social relationships and their schoolwork and other things like that. So, you know, I don't think anyone knows for sure the reason for these changes in mental health in young people. There are a number of interesting hypotheses, which I think are important to look into, but we do need to, whatever the cause of this change across time, we do need to understand that this is a key phase of life for helping people early before the problems get to the point where they are really severe and perhaps they're coming into the emergency room or the need to be hospitalized or, you know, maybe part of the criminal justice system and things like that. So there is an increasing crisis. We're still understanding what the impact of the pandemic will be in the long term, but there are many people who are quite concerned about the second wave of impact of the pandemic may well be yet to occur, and it will be in this mental health area rather than the physical health elements, which have been rightly the main focus up until now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we're all seeing greater incidence of domestic violence, of mental health disorders, of worsening cardiovascular disease. You know, we're not getting active cancer screenings like we once did. And so we're seeing increases in the prevalence of certain cancers and all of these things. And it will take us easily a decade, if not 50 to 100 years, to fully understand the impact not only of the viral infection, but the fear-based media circus that also just was so in our lives. I used to get up every single morning and listen to 10 minutes of just highlights of news, and I had to give it up 2 years ago, and I was just, I cannot have this stressor in my life anymore. And I have also gone very deep down the rabbit hole of true crime podcasts. And because of it, I am going to take a detox and just go, I don't need to hear about serial killers 24 hours a day.
Yeah, that's a fascinating trend. And it's not really highly relevant, but my wife is also an enthusiastic a consumer of true crime podcasts and TV shows, and a number of other people I know, and I've done it to a certain extent. I think my interest is less than hers, but I don't know what the answer is, why we became so obsessed with these stories, but we did as a culture. We really, these are some of the most popular shows on Netflix, and there's a huge number of podcasts that deal with true crime, and obviously it's interesting and you're solving a problem, but it also creates a sense of danger. You know, that these things are happening all the time, you know, and you know, it may well be that many people now have the feeling that this kind of danger is much greater than it is objectively. So, you know, and then you have to ask questions about things like anxiety and how is that feeding into experiences of anxiety, because, you know, the problems that we're really seeing increase are problems of depression and anxiety. They are the two kinds of problems that we're really seeing an increase in young people over this period.
I completely agree with you. There are certain times that I will be listening and I'm just like, I don't need to fill my brain with this. And, you know, Ashley Flowers, who is a very famous true crime podcaster, said that somehow over the past 30 years, since I guess Dateline came out and Unsolved Mysteries and all these things, it's become an American pastime to just like study true crime. But you're right, it is stressful and it does give that sense of danger. So anyways, I could talk true crime all day, but let's get back to behavioral
it's
health.
It's also fascinating, which is the problem, right?
Uh-huh. You
know, very fascinating, yeah.
It is fascinating. And so, we talked with Dr. Erica Gray, who runs a genomics company. When it comes to combining medical health, especially mental health records, which are even more highly classified than regular health records, with big technology, big data, we've seen huge transformations in the past couple of years with big tech. There are so many ethical concerns that come up when you're tying your mental health history to your phone. So talk to us about how do you and your colleagues at Kasana really navigate these ethical waters?
Yeah, so it's a great question and obviously an absolutely critical one. You know, there's lots of aspects to this question. I think the fundamental one, though, is to say that data is data is power. Data, information is power. And so you have to ask yourself, who are we empowering with the data? And that's the fundamental question. And of course, in our case, our values and our mission says that we aim to empower the person who's using the product, that is someone who's seeking to improve their mental health. And we make sure that we're not empowering, to the best of our ability, anyone else. So a classic example would be, as we know, a lot of the big tech sites collect data on how you use them, and they use that to target you with advertising. I would argue that that's not empowering to you because often you do not fully understand how the data is being used. Someone else is making a lot of money off it, not you. And then it's being used to manipulate you, with this advertising approach. So, you know, we obviously, you know, as we're a healthcare company, we're absolutely not going down that road. So we aim, you know, that's the first thing. You've got to get the principle right. We aim to empower the user or empower a practitioner who is helping them. The second thing is, obviously you've got to do everything technically correct. So you've got to have really strong security and privacy procedures that are both technical in terms of how you set up your computer systems and all that kind of thing, but also in terms of most of the problems, you won't be surprised to know, with data security arise because of humans, right? And so you've also got to have really good human management procedures, training, oversight, and so forth, to make sure that the humans in the system are doing a really good job with people's data. And certainly we aim to do all of that kind of thing. You know, and then, you know, we work on processing the data in a way that's privacy preserving. So even though we're collecting data on things like language and movement, there are ways of processing that allow us to reduce the likelihood that you could ever know who that data came from. You know, there's this concept of the data being de-identified, which means we took your name off it. But then there's also the concept of it being anonymized, which means if you look at the data, I can't work out who you are. Mm-hmm. And they're two different things. So, for example, we can de-identify your GPS data, but it's not anonymized because I can work out where you live based on that. And so there are ways that you can process that's secure. But at the end of the day, we know that people are willing to trust others with their data if they get value from it. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you use a product like Google Maps, or if you use an Alexa at home or something like that, you are letting someone use your data because you get something valuable back. And we need to make sure that equation makes sense for the people who are using the product, that they are sharing their data, but that they are getting a value for doing that.
Mm-hmm. Do you have discussions, I'm sure you do, about overreach? Because I know that with a lot of like the COVID trackers and things, people are like, this is just overreaching. Like, I don't need to know. I don't need an alert to come to my phone to say, hey, you happen to be at the grocery store within an hour of someone who tested positive for COVID. Like, how do you navigate that? You know, and yes, you're empowering the user, empowering the person who is interpreting this data. But, you know, how do you not keep going and just go one step too far?
Yeah, well, you know, obviously it depends what you mean by step too far, but mostly what we mean is that we're collecting data in a way that's not empowering to the user, right? You know, we're either collecting it just to collect it, or we're collecting it for some other reason, like we're going to sell it or whatever. And certainly we're not going to sell it. We're not a government entity. We're not using it for any kind of surveillance purpose. And we only collect the data that we think we need in order to give people accurate information about their own behavioral health. And we put the person in charge of what happens to the data. They see it, they can control it, they can determine who else gets to see it. And that's really the critical thing. And the other big thing, of course, is informed consent. So, you know, this is a fundamental feature of research. You know, you can't do research, you know, ethically without making sure that the person fully understands what you're collecting, why you're collecting, and what you're going to do with it. And of course, we know that all the apps we use have these big long terms and conditions, things that nobody ever reads. You flip through them because you're just saying, oh, I just want to install the app, just bing. But so, you know, there are things you can do to make sure that the person who's using it really does understand at a deeper level than just flicking through the terms and conditions, which is often just a legal cover your ass thing, frankly, for the company. Mm-hmm. Rather than something that's truly designed to promote understanding in the person of what data's been collected, why is it being collected, what's it going to be used for, and what's it not going to be used for. And if you're really clear with people about those things, then I think the problem of overreach becomes less difficult, because the person is then empowered to make a choice. I do or don't want you to have those data. If you don't, fine, don't use the product, right? Mm-hmm. And if you do, then you know exactly what's going on and there's no surprises.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, you know, we gotta bring the conversation to a close, but I feel like we're just getting started. Talk to me as we end here about, you know, now we've got all this data. We know how active people are, how much they're sleeping. We probably know a little bit about either body composition or what are they eating, all of these things. Then what? How does that translate into helping to prevent youth depression, helping to prevent substance abuse, and helping to prevent sleep disorders? And as we discussed with Dr. Daniel Amina, how do we actively prevent suicidality and active suicides in our youth? How does this data then translate into improvements in mental health?
Yeah, so that's a big question, obviously. So I'll zero in on one part of it that relates to the last example you gave of suicide prevention. So one of the things that we're very bad at in healthcare generally, but particularly in mental health, is what I call when questions. And what I mean by when questions is like, when is the best time to intervene, to provide support, to be most effective for the person? And that's because we've built a healthcare system that says, I'm the doctor, you come and see me. You come and sit in my waiting room, you walk into my office, I assess you, I tell you what to do, and then you walk out and you live your life and you hope that somehow what you did in that little appointment sticks and makes a difference. Now, if you're taking a medication, sure, that might work because you've got the ongoing effects of the medication occurring biologically, which hopefully help with whatever the difficulty is you're trying to overcome. But in behavioral healthcare, that's a lot more tricky because it involves that behavior change element, which is really hard to achieve. Suicide's a very compelling example here because we know that if you can reach out to people at the time when they're most at risk for making an attempt, that's often when you can have the biggest effect. So, for example, many of the most effective suicide prevention approaches actually reduce access to lethal means, which then makes it harder to make the attempt. And then often with a little bit of extra time, people rethink things and they don't go on to do it. So, for example, putting medicines into blister packs rather than bottles, you know, makes it harder to overdose. If you own a firearm, then making sure you store the ammunition away from the firearm, that also reduces suicide risk. So there's a lot of things that we can do, putting barriers on bridges or on other places where people might jump. So you've got all of these things. So we know that if you can create a little bit of friction or resistance at the time when someone's feeling most vulnerable, then you can actually prevent the suicide. So going back to the digital data, if we can build a system which gives people an alert that they can reach out for different kinds of support, maybe it pushes information to them at that time about a suicide crisis prevention line or something like that. And once again, we know if someone calls the suicide prevention line, they're much less likely to attempt. So we know if we can do that at the right time, then it's going to be much more effective than it occurring perhaps in the doctor's office. And that's where digital technology can really play a role because it is ubiquitous. It's part of our daily lives now. You know, we've got our phones, we've got our smartwatches. In 5 years, many of us will be wearing augmented reality glasses, probably, whether you like it or not, that's probably coming. And so, you know, there's all sorts of things about wearable computing that are going to change the game here. And the point is to be able to ultimately understand when is the best time to support someone to have the best effect in terms of preventing a bad outcome.
Mm-hmm. I love what you said about creating friction around things. And, you know, as a pharmacist, I also am just like, we have to create a lot of protections and barriers for children to have access to their parents' medications, since some of the medications are very, very dangerous in children. I'm curious, just to end on a high note, and unfortunately, a ton of the medications that are used to treat mental health disorders, they just don't work that well, and they have huge side effect burdens. And, you know, I think of the atypical antipsychotics and how much weight gain they cause. I think of the typical antipsychotics and all the movements, all the tardive dyskinesias that happen. Antidepressants just simply don't help that much for a ton of people. And so I'm curious, what have been some of your like best turnaround stories? Who are the patients that you just remember? Because one of the things that is so broken in Western medicine is patients become numbers. They become numbers on a spreadsheet instead of retaining their humanity. And so what inspires you? Like, what are some of the real human aspects of your job that give you the inspiration to keep going?
Well, thank you. That's a wonderful question. I've done a lot of clinical practice, you know, as a psychologist, and you know, I can think of many, many cases where people have come in with such a powerful sense of hopelessness, of being stuck. And, you know, the interesting thing is often when you start working with them and you start to suggest that maybe there is a way through this, you know, they'll argue with you vociferously. You know, they'll say, no, you don't understand. You know, this situation really is hopeless. Like, I'm the hardest case. I'm worse than anyone else. I'm not going to get better. And of course, to a certain extent, that's often their, you know, the depression talking or the anxiety talking, something like that. But, you know, but the important thing in my experience is to stick with your optimism, even if it doesn't seem to be landing, because I've had many, many people I've worked with who've later on said, you know, Nick, you know, early on when I came in here and you just kept being positive and you kept telling me that we can do this and that there's a way forward, that meant so much to me. And I'm thinking to myself, like, wow, I had no idea. Like, I thought that you weren't hearing a thing I was saying because you were feeling so terrible. So often, even when you don't, it's not apparent that the person is absorbing the positive message, it is still getting in there. And over time, with persistence and care and support and, you know, and not giving up on people, which is really critical, you know, things start to turn around. And so I think that there is that possibility. You know, I've always been interested in this idea of the healing relationship that you can have in therapy. And that's why I went into clinical psychology in the first place. And I think that, you know, it is very powerful, and many people get great benefit from it. You know, the medicines are very helpful for many people too, but we need to find the right, everyone's different. Mm-hmm. And so we need to find the right package of solutions for each person. Very often it will involve a combination of things in mental health. You know, sometimes the counseling or the psychotherapy may be combined with using some digital supports like we've been talking about, maybe combined with some medication, you know, and finding the right package. But it's often hard to personalize the treatment at the same time when someone's feeling so defeated and so low in their energy, you know. So that's often the challenge, helping to support them through that process of exploration of finding the personalized treatment that really is going to be the right one for them.
Absolutely. You're preaching to the choir. I am all about the individualized medicine, or I guess is what they're calling it these days, precision medicine, about being very precise about the interventions. And I just want to remind our listeners as we close today of the words of Sheryl Sandberg. In her book, Option B, she very much echoes what you are saying, Dr. Allen, that oftentimes when bad things happen to us, we have the three P's that hold us back from getting over the bad things. We tell ourselves that it's pervasive, permanent, and personal. And it's, you know, everything is bad. It will always be bad. And it's my fault that it is bad. If you can stop yourself from thinking that way and just understand that, you know what? I didn't have a great interview today, but I still got a roof over my head, so it's not that pervasive. It is temporary, and it's not your fault. It's not your fault. Life just throws things at us. And so take us out. Tell us how our listeners can find out more about you, about Kasana, and the work that you do.
So, yeah, so you can, the easiest way is to look at the Kasana Health website. It's often important to spell Kasana for people because it's an unusual word. It's K-S-A-N-A, health.com. So all one word, kasanahealth.com. And you can certainly find out about our approach and some of our products there. I'm also a professor of clinical psychology at the University of Oregon. And so, you know, you can find out about my work there as well. So they're two good ways to find out and get in touch.
I love it. And I love the word Kasana. I looked it up as we were preparing for today's show. And in Buddhist teachings, a Kasana is 1/75 of a second. So it's all about making one tiny change at a time.
Beautiful. That's exactly right. It's the smallest, in Buddhist philosophy, it's the smallest amount of time you can become aware of and become aware of the opportunity associated with that moment. And that's what we're trying to work on, using these digital data so that people are aware of the opportunity in each moment to make a positive change.
Absolutely. The power is in the pause, as my friend Jody Cohen says all the time. So Dr. Nick Allen, thank you so much for coming in today and being a guest on The Lindsay Elmore Show.
Thank you, Lindsay. It's been great to be with you.
By now, everyone's heard of CBD oil. While some people swear by it, others have not seen the results they were hoping for. And that is where Eaton Hemp comes in. They offer unfiltered, USDA-certified organic full-spectrum CBD oil that is minimally processed and infused with their own hemp seed oil. This allows you to get the full entourage effect as well as maximum absorption, potency, and effectiveness. All of that means results. Not only does Eaton provide one of the cleanest CBD products on the market, but they pride themselves on transparency. Eaton Hemp is farmer-owned and strongly believes in whole plant nutrition. That's why they leave the CBD unfiltered, so all of the elements of the hemp plant can work in unison. Eaton Hemp is so confident in the results that their CBD will offer you, they will give you a full 30-day money-back guarantee, no questions asked. So if you aren't satisfied with the product, they'll refund you. No problem. As a special offer for our podcast listeners, you can save 25% on all Eaton Hemp products and still get your full money-back guarantee when you head to www.eatonhemp.com/Lindsay Elmore Show. That's www.eatonhemp.com/Lindsay Elmore Show to save 25%. Be sure to use the show's link so that Eaton Hemp knows that we sent you. Head to www.eatonhemp.com/Lindsay Elmore Show and shop now. The Lindsay Elmore Show is written and produced by me, Lindsay Elmore. Show segments are produced by Sue Procco and Derek Lugo. Sound design and editing is by Jive Media. Support The Lindsay Elmore Show by heading to lindsayelmore.com/podcast. Your contribution, no matter how big or how small, helps us to bring the best guests to the interview chair. Thank you so much for listening. Subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Share this and all of your favorite episodes with a friend and on social media. Be sure to tag @Lindsay Elmore Show and help us bring the pod to more people.